Now it'll be my privilege and opportunity to introduce Dr. Brown to you. Dr. Richard B. Brown currently serves as the Dean of the College of Engineering at the University of Utah. He holds appointments in the School of Computing, Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering, and Department of Bioengineering. He previously taught at the University of Michigan and was involved in industry for a number of years. Also learned today of his entrepreneurial background. Dr. Brown has conducted major research projects in high-performance, low-power mixed-signal microprocessor design, and in solid-state sensors of many kinds. He received his bachelor's and master's degree in electrical engineering from Brigham Young University. He then worked in industry for nearly 6 years before returning to school at the University of Utah and completing his Ph.D. in electrical engineering in 1985. Dr. Brown has served in a number of positions in the church, including as a missionary to Finland, counselor in a bishopric, bishop, stake mission president, counselor in a stake presidency. Dr. Brown and his wife, Brenda, are the parents of 4 children, and currently they have 1 granddaughter. We're grateful again for Dr. and Sister Brown being here with us today and look forward to the opportunity of hearing Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. I spent 2 happy months on this campus learning Finnish 40 years ago when the language training mission was at Ricks College. The last time I was scheduled to speak here, I had a little problem because I was flying up and the Idaho Falls airport was fogged in. So I spent the morning sitting at the Salt Lake airport trying to get here, and then emailing my slides to my colleagues who gave my talk for me here. So I'm very happy to be here with you today, and I thank you for coming. I believe Dean Peck wanted me to help you understand engineering. All disciplines are important. We live in a very interconnected and interdependent world. But in general, engineering is not well understood by the public. Some of you may think, as my wife Brenda did when she first met me, that as an engineer, I would wear a striped cap and drive a train. Now, I would not want to disparage in any way those who drive trains, but that's not really what we're talking about when we think about engineering these days. I hope that by being here today, you will better understand how engineers contribute to society, and that you'll realize what a wonderful time it is we live in. And maybe some of you will even consider a career in engineering. So, what is an engineer? Engineering is built on a foundation of science, math, physics, chemistry, but there's another component in engineering that is creativity. I like the quote by Theodore von Karman, "Scientists discover the world that exists. Engineers create the world that never was." It's that creative part of engineering that's always been the most exciting to me. At the University of Utah, we offer degrees in most of the engineering disciplines, bioengineering, chemical engineering, civil and environmental engineering, computer science, electrical engineering, material science and engineering, mechanical engineering, and nuclear engineering. I wish I had time to talk about each one of these because they're all really exciting disciplines and they all affect our lives in important ways. If you think about what engineering is all about, in my view, it's about serving humanity by improving the quality of life. First of all, engineers develop the tools for scientific exploration. Whether it's the rocket ship shown on this slide or the single photon microscope, there's a whole range of instrumentation that's developed by engineers that allow us to move forward our understanding of the world. Engineers have had a huge impact on communications. Some of you may enjoy as much as I do these smartphone gadgets. I'm old enough to remember when we had to find a payphone. And it was so hard to get in touch with people. If you needed to pick someone up or meet someone, it was almost impossible. Now we're all connected to each other in many ways, most of them good ways. Engineers develop the infrastructure, shown here as a bridge, but the water system, the roads, the railroads, all of that infrastructure, including the structure of buildings, is very important to our quality of lives. And in the U.S. right now, we have an aging infrastructure. So there's going to be a lot of work required in the next few years to renew the infrastructure that makes our lives safe and enjoyable. It's engineers who are working on cleaning up the environment, who are working on making engines more efficient and cleaner and so on. And it's even engineers who are involved in entertainment. One of our graduates from the University of Utah, Ed Catmull, is a founder of Pixar Animation. He's now the president of Pixar Disney Animation. Basically runs both of those companies, animation. And I'm guessing that a number of people here enjoy those Pixar movies as much as I do. Even as adults, they're enjoyable. But what wonderful entertainment. And there are a number of other kinds of entertainment that have a big involvement from engineers. Other areas that are important right now are energy. Both finding more energy, finding alternative forms of energy, and making sure that we use energy efficiently. This is one of the grand challenges of our day. Shown in the lower left corner here is a picture of the nuclear reactor that's at the University of Utah in the Merrill Engineering Building. I believe that this country is going to have to invest in nuclear technology that we originally developed for power production and then left behind for others to take the lead. But at this point, we really need every form of energy that we can find, and particularly if it's as clean as nuclear power is. Engineering has had a huge impact on our productivity. One of the major reasons that the U.S. has a high standard of living is that we're very productive. The average productivity in this country has led the world. One of the reasons that we're so productive is that we were early adopters of computers in many ways in industry. There are areas of engineering that are focused on making production more efficient. Engineers are involved in safety. I was visiting with Professor Neff this morning, and he reminded me of a story I told him years ago about my life being saved by an airbag. I'm pretty grateful for the engineers who put airbags in cars, because when I had a head-on collision and was able to walk away from the accident, it was because of that technology. There are so many examples of that. And in this country, we are protected from many dangers because of these engineering developments that have been made through the years. And finally, health care. I'm guessing that most of you would not think about health care as something that engineers are particularly involved in. So I decided today to focus more on engineering involvement in healthcare. There's some very exciting things happening. I'd like to introduce this with Isaiah's words. In chapter 35, he prophesies of the latter days when the desert will blossom as a rose, Israel will be gathered, and the Lord will come. Included in that chapter are these familiar verses you see on the slide. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap as an hart, and the tongue of the dumb sing. These words are familiar because they're the basis of the lyrics in Handel's Messiah that many of us love. We live in an exciting day, the day of which Isaiah was speaking. And I thought you'd be interested to know how engineers collaborating with physicians and scientists are working toward fulfilling this vision. I'll give a few examples of each of these from research that's being conducted by faculty members at the University of Utah, along with their graduate students and even undergraduates. It's important to say that progress in these areas is collaborative, both between medicine and engineering and between engineering disciplines. It's not just bioengineers who are working in these bionic advances, but also electrical engineers, materials scientists, mechanical engineers, computer scientists, and many others. First of all, the deaf shall hear. I'm sure a number of people in this audience know someone who has a cochlear prosthesis. I'd be interested to see by show of hands, how many of you know someone who has a cochlear prosthesis? A lot of people. There are now more than 30,000 adults and 30,000 children in the United States who wear cochlear prostheses. And in the world, it's approaching 200,000 patients. For those of you who aren't so familiar with this technology, when a person's hair cells in the inner ear, the cochlea, cease to function, it's often possible to stimulate the nerves that are at the base of those hair cells electronically. And the person perceives sound. So a little array of electrodes is placed inside the cochlea. It's a bit tricky as surgeries go because it has to be wrapped around that cochlea. And it has to be close to the inner wall of the cochlea. And then current is driven into those electrodes and it stimulates the nerves. Traditionally, these cochlear prostheses, as you see in the image, had a very little amount of electronics implanted, and most of the electronics was external. There was a battery pack and signal processing that was worn in a tummy pack, and the wires would run up under a person's clothing to the device shown on the outside of the skull here that's held in place by a magnet, by the way, and then the signals and the energy to drive the electrodes is coupled through the skin, and the microphone is also placed there so it's close to the ear to make hearing as natural as possible. Now, some people don't really like wearing the tummy pack. And in general, you've probably noticed that electronics through the years have become smaller and smaller. You now have more compute power in your smartphone than we used to have in the big computers that filled rooms. So I was involved in a project that had the goal of shrinking the electronics for cochlear prostheses so that it would be possible to implant the total device, so that there wouldn't have to be a tummy pack. The idea was that a person could have the batteries as well as the electronics implanted inside the skull. You'd have coils placed under the skin so that you could sleep on a pillow that had coils and recharge the batteries. And you'd need about 18 hours worth of battery power to get you through the next day. So this is a diagram of what we had in mind. This was a project that was run as an engineering research center, which is the biggest form of funding that the National Science Foundation does. And you can see in the diagram on the left some integrated circuits that are mounted at the base of this device, and then a cable that runs down to another little integrated circuit that actually drives the currents into the electrodes, which are wrapped inside the cochlea. Typically nowadays, people use 8 electrodes. So sound doesn't sound exactly like it does to people with normal hearing. It's filtered. So Beethoven sounds more like Mickey Mouse. But you can understand speech. So one of the objects we had in this project was to make a device with many more electrodes so that you'd have much higher fidelity in the sound. And we built, this was done by other faculty and their students, but they developed electrode arrays that had 64, 128 electrodes. My group's contribution was to design a microprocessor that would process the sound, run the algorithm that is used to convert sound to the pulses that drive these electrodes, and do this all with little enough power that it could be implanted. So you see on the right the microprocessor that we designed for that purpose. The larger square in the lower left is actually a digital signal processor that's completely programmable and runs the algorithm that's used for doing this sound conversion. We were very sensitive in this design about the amount of power that is dissipated. We did build a full mock-up of this system on a printed circuit board, obviously much too large to implant. We were able to test it all out, and we even built a graphical user interface. This was done by some students at the University of Utah, and that GUI, as it's called, the graphical user interface, is made to look exactly like the ones that are used with the standard cochlear prostheses, so that the physician can tune the device to the patient's hearing at each frequency, changing the amplitude so that they get the best balance in sound. So you see at the bottom part of this slide, the signals that are being transmitted from the microprocessor into the electrodes and a representation of the pulses themselves that drive the electrodes. So another project related to helping those who are lame. There have been a number of people, especially during the recent conflicts in the Middle East and Afghanistan, who've lost arms due to these roadside bombs. A project at the University of Utah has been aimed at giving them a much more natural use of an artificial arm. The object was to make contact with the nerve bundle that runs down what's left of their arm and connect it to the prosthetic arm. And the electrodes that are shown here at the bottom with different lengths of probes would connect to different nerves in the nerve bundle. This project, like most of these projects, was done by a large team of people. Professor Dick Norman developed these arrays of brain probes originally. It's called the Utah Array. Greg Clark is a bioengineer. Reed Harrison designs analog circuitry. Florian Salzbacher is an electrical engineer. And they all work together to interface a person's nervous system to the prosthetic arm. Here's a representation of how that's done. You see the spikes on the bottom, circuitry that's made on another piece of silicon that is placed on top of it, passive components, inductors and capacitors that are put together on the substrate, and then the whole piece is encapsulated with antennas on top of the brain probes and the electronics. The body is actually a very difficult environment to protect electronics in, so everything has to be encapsulated to keep it from getting moist and short-circuiting things. So here's a little video clip I wanted to show you from KSL News that describes the application.
Tiny electronic chips implanted in the brain of a 25-year-old man can read his thoughts, then transform what he thinks into actually doing things outside his body.
Mind-boggling? Yeah, Ed Yates tells us it's just the beginning. And that it is, Dick, for the first time, hair-thin electrodes that were built inside a lab here in Salt Lake are now inside the mind of this 25-year-old quadriplegic in Boston. His mind moves matter, and others like him will soon follow.
Yes, channel down. Now I'm going to channel up.
Matthew Nagel can turn lights and his television on and off, adjust the channels and volume, control his computer, and read his email, all by just thinking about it.
I can't put it into words. It's just, I used my brain. I just thought it. I said, cursor, go up to the top right, and it did. And now I got control of it all over the screen. It's wild.
Wild may be an understatement. The 25-year-old is using his mind to do things he hasn't done on his own since a knife attack left him paralyzed from the neck down 4 years ago. 100 hair-thin electrodes implanted a millimeter deep in the motor cortex of his brain are picking up the same thought signals that would have been sent to his arms and hands. Now they're being converted to make computer-controlled objects do the same thing.
Now close. Nice. Open. Close. Not bad, man. Not bad at all.
Matthew continues, moving a prosthetic hand again by just thinking about it. While CyberKinetics, which designed the implant for Matthew, builds its own electrodes inside this clean room at the University of Utah Research Park, researchers across campus are designing others for other experiments.
This is where the microchips are fabricated, but with this new research now unfolding rapidly, labs like this are only going to get bigger and better.
Richard Norman, Reed Harrison, Florian Salzbacher, and their colleagues are looking at implants not only for the brain, but for peripheral nerves, nerves which still may carry messages even after a limb has been severed. These electrodes will interface not just one, but all of the fibers inside a nerve.
The person will look perfectly normal. The implant system will be powered wirelessly, and signals will be sent from the implanted system to the outside world wirelessly.
Okay. The Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, dubbed DARPA, is so intrigued with the possibilities, it's now challenging researchers with big bucks to develop implantable electrodes and prosthetics that border on science fiction.
Basically, the recreation of a human arm. The ultimate goal of this request for proposal is to have an individual, an amputee, be able to play a piano, to be able to fret a guitar, and to be able to thread a needle.
Unbelievable, perhaps unreachable, but that's how far researchers are being told to push the envelope. Researchers do believe these new implants might even dispatch signals to the body's own muscles, cut off, say, from a spinal cord injury. Incidentally, Dick and Dini, that last prosthetic hand that we showed you on this report was also built here in Salt Lake City by Utah company Motion Control, which is a spinoff of university research.
We'll have to believe they will get to that point. I mean, you really do.
Possibilities.
So as Ed Yates said, the laboratories are only getting bigger and better. This is an artist's conception of the new U-Star building, which is being built on the University of Utah's campus. And the wing of the building that goes off to the right is a nanofabrication laboratory, which will make the University of Utah a leading institution in the kind of technology with which we build those brain probes and MEMS devices and circuits. So I don't want to give any false impressions. There's a lot of work left to be done. But it is pretty interesting to see that kind of a brain-machine interface, and it will lead to bigger and better things. I'll tell you now about some of the work that my students have done. We've also worked on brain probes. All of these brain probes that you've seen so far are just looking at the electrical signals in the brain. There's a lot of information in the electrical signals. But as you know, there are also neurotransmitters, chemical signals in the brain that are equally important. It's kind of like going from a black and white picture to a color picture. There's a lot more information there. My own PhD was at the University of Utah, and my project was solid-state liquid chemical sensors. So I don't want to get off track on that, but what my students did is add chemical sensing to brain probes. So in the upper right here, you see an array of electrodes that we made on silicon, and there, those electrodes are configured in a manner that allows us to do what's called amperometric sensing. As we change a voltage, certain chemicals, analytes, are either oxidized or reduced at the electrode. And we can tell from the amount of current what the concentration is of those chemicals. And you see in the plots below, the plot on the left is for dopamine, and the one on the right is for serotonin. These are very important neural transmitters. So we built this array, which is at the very center of the integrated circuit that you see at the top. And then we packaged up this silicon chip with a little incubation chamber on top of it. And we then cultivated human stem cells so that they would differentiate into neurons. So we grew a little layer of brain tissue on top of this integrated circuit. And this particular cell line that we were using was particularly useful for this application because the neurons would spontaneously fire. They didn't have to be stimulated to make them talk. And in our little two-dimensional slice of brain tissue, we could see one neuron firing, and it would stimulate its neighbor to fire, and that would stimulate the next neighbor, so we'd see little ripples of activity across the chip. But we could also see the chemical concentrations in the vicinity of the neurons. So the plot that you see here represents the electrical signals as the spikes, and the heavy line behind those is dopamine concentration. And we saw a very interesting characteristic, which was the neuron would fire in rapid succession, 6 or 8 times, and then it would release dopamine. Again, this cell line had the characteristic of releasing dopamine. So we were able to do some very interesting studies. The next step was to make an in vivo version of this, a brain probe that could actually be impaled into brain tissue, like the probes that you saw earlier in the presentation. The difference being that these brain probes had chemical sensors as well. So we were able to monitor the neuronal spikes, the local field potentials, which is kind of an aggregate signal from neurons firing, and the chemical concentration in the brain. We did some interesting experiments with anesthetized rats in which we stimulated the medial forebrain bundle. This is a bundle of nerves that's bidirectional, and it's kind of the pleasure nerves. When they're stimulated, an animal or a person feels pleasure. As we stimulated those nerves, the rat's brain secreted dopamine in exactly the part of the brain that we expected it to be secreted at, and we could do experiments changing the amplitude and frequency of the signals we were stimulating it with, and we could see the resulting change in concentration of neurochemicals. This is an example of developing tools for scientific discovery. Now, moving on to the more recent work, this is pertinent to helping make the tongue of the dumb sing, or at least speak. So this is, again, a collaborative project. My student, Spencer Kellis, is an electrical engineering student. We're working with Professor Bradley Greger, who's in bioengineering, and Paul House, who's a brain surgeon. Dr. House does surgery on patients who have severe epilepsy. Epilepsy is a disease that tends to strike young men more than women, and usually in their early 20s. In many cases, it can be treated successfully with drugs, but there are cases where a person has seizures multiple times a day and they're not able to get it under control with medication. In those cases, the treatment is to put probes right on the surface of the brain, and then when a seizure comes, map the signals, unhealthy signals, back to their source. It works just like a global positioning system, so that the doctor can tell the source of these signals, and then he goes in and excises that part of the brain. And it's very effective at treating epilepsy. You might lose a little functionality or a little memory or something, but you get your life back. So these patients who are being treated in this manner for epilepsy have sometimes allowed us to put some other probes on their brains. If you look at the figure on the right, the figure on the left shows the normal electrodes. They're called ECOGs. They're about a centimeter in diameter, and they're placed in a matrix across the brain. On the right hand, you see a close-up of four of those ECOG electrodes, but also you see the Utah array that was used in that earlier experiment with Matthew Nagel. It's on the right. And then I hope you can see some very faint green wires. Those are micro-ECOG electrodes that are being used in our experiment. We noticed that the brain doesn't really like to have probes in it. There's this foreign body reaction, and the body tries to separate itself from any foreign body, and so it blocks it off. And so in the case of someone like Matthew Nagel, they had to reprogram that computer regularly to keep it working. So we thought we might be much more successful for chronic applications if we left the electrodes just on the surface of the brain. So we're underneath the pia, the skin layer that protects the brain, but we're not penetrating into the cortex. So these are 40 micron diameter wires that are our electrodes. And the first question was, how much information can we get from the surface of the brain? So in our early studies, we looked at signals from adjacent electrodes, and we looked at how close they could be to each other and still have independent information. The brain is organized in a columnar fashion so that a whole column of the cortex kind of gets added up and the signals appear on the surface as a field potential. And these signals have a frequency and an amplitude associated with them. So we measured the unique information and decided that if we had these electrodes 2 or 3 millimeters apart, they got quite independent information. Then we did some experiments, again with these epilepsy patients who were willing to let us to cooperate with us in our experiments. The first experiment was to have the patient move a computer mouse either to the left or to the right and then click the mouse. We didn't know which direction they were moving it, but we recorded the signals from their brains. And then Spencer Kellis developed the signal processing algorithms to analyze this data. And we soon got to the point that we knew which direction their hand was going to move about half a second before they moved their hand. And we were accurate 100% of the time, just from the signals on the surface of the brain. Moving beyond that, we decided it would be a great advance forward if we could detect speech from the surface of the brain. I had a friend when we were living in Michigan who developed Lou Gehrig's disease. And as that disease progresses, a person gradually loses their ability to control their body. Their mind is perfectly sound, but they can't move their arms, their hands. Eventually, they can't move their vocal cords. It's a terrible thing. And a person ends up in a condition that's called locked-in syndrome. Some people have strokes that leave them in the same condition. My own mother had a stroke. The last 4 or 5 years of her life, she really couldn't speak. She could understand what we were saying, but something had been damaged that made it impossible for her to speak. We wanted to be able to help these people who have locked-in syndrome to communicate. And so we started positioning our electrodes over different parts of the brain where we thought we could get pertinent signals. The first of those areas is called Wernicke's area. It's an area of the brain that's known to be associated with language, but it's more in the formation of words and the understanding of language. The other place we put our electrodes was on the motor cortex, in the part of the motor cortex that controls the mouth and throat. And then we started collecting data, and you were looking at real data from real patients during different tasks, conversation, verbal tasks, and verbal rewards, somebody telling them, well done. And we extract from this data frequency and energy for multiple electrodes over time. And we characterize that data in a way that we can represent it in n-dimensional space. And what you see at the bottom is a representation of the pronunciation of hungry and thirsty. And you'll see that in this approach to signal processing, we get clusters of data so that if we drew a circle or a sphere around those red dots, any time that we see signals in those red dots, we assume the person has said hungry. So the goal here is just to be able to develop a vocabulary that would allow these people to communicate. You can imagine how much better life would be if a patient was able to say, I'm hungry, I'm cold, I love you, instead of not being able to communicate at all. So we have done a study using 10 words. The decoding of these words is not perfect. You can see with hungry and thirsty, we're right 88% of the time with the initial studies we did. This is work that's just at the very early stages. But we are many times better than random chance. So we believe that this is the beginning of development that will one day be able to help these patients to communicate with their loved ones and caregivers and improve their lives significantly. Now, finally, I'd like to talk about helping the blind to see. This is a project connected to a company called Second Sight, and one of our faculty members, Gianluca Lozzi, is involved in this. In this approach, a small camera is put into glasses. The camera picks up an image, which is transmitted through the stem of the glasses to the electronics that's implanted in the person, very much like the cochlear prosthesis. It goes to an antenna that wirelessly relays that information and the power to this array that's on the back of the eye that connects to the retina. And again, like the cochlear prosthesis, there are nerves there that can still pick up signals even if the retina is no longer functioning, and then it transmits the data down the optic nerve to the brain. So again, this is early work. These devices have been built with 64 electrodes at this point. They're working on devices that have many more electrodes than that. But I wanted to show you a patient.
Here. Even though it's oak, it appears dark. And then I turn my head to the left, and right there is where the window starts, right on the edge right there. And then coming over this way, and I get around about this point here, I can see the light coming through the sliding glass door over there. It starts to get bright.
You can imagine the difference in a person's quality of life if they had just enough vision to be able to navigate around their kitchen or their home. I appreciate these patients both because they were willing to be the experimental patients and because they were willing to let us use the video. I got permission just 2.5 hours ago to use this video because you have to be very careful these days with patients' rights. But these patients can read large letters. They can recognize a cup or a fork or a plate. They can't see things in great detail. They see through spots. This is an 8x8 array of spots. And you'll notice the patient was moving his head back and forth. That was so that he could cover more of the image with the spots that he has to see through. Now I'm going to show you another video of a patient who has one of these. I should say these patients are completely blind. They're not allowed to do the experimental implants on anyone who has any vision at all. These patients are blind. The next one is of a woman that you may think could see even better than she can. Watch this. This is
come on, a little faster. No one expects Grandma to play like a professional, but for Linda Morford, that any ball goes in is amazing. She's totally blind. The small circle in her glasses is a camera, and some clever electronics turns the images into patterns of dark and light. It may not sound like much, but for Linda, it's made a huge difference.
Now, she can't really see the rim. What she can see is the backboard because it's white and it stands out. And she knows where the rim is on the backboard. She had vision earlier in her life and then had a degenerative eye disease that took the vision from her. So these are early examples of our efforts to help people in ways that simply haven't been available to them in the past, other than through miraculous blessings that we know of people receiving. But in summary, I would say this is a great time to live. It's wonderful to have this kind of technology. And engineers are playing an important part in solving many of the world's grand challenges in energy, the environment, the built infrastructure, improving productivity, communications, and also in healthcare. I'm glad to have been able to share some of these things with you, and I'll be happy to stay around if there are questions after. Thank you.